Good morning, Mendocino. This is Jeff Blankford welcoming you to the March 14th edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month, and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to you, our listeners. Last weekend, I was in Washington attending and participating in a workshop at the Occupy APAC conference, which was dwarfed both in size and importance by the annual policy conference of APAC itself. APAC being the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, for new listeners to this program. Next to the President's State of the Union Address, which is a one-evening event, APAC's annual policy conference is the most important gathering that takes place in our nation's capital, and some could argue with good reason that in matters of war and peace, the APAC conference carries more significance with each year's attendance, far surpassing that of the one before. This year, the number topped 13,000. Well exceeding the record of 10,000 of 2011. And as last year included some 600 college students, many of them presidents of their student body, who APAC hopes to seduce into its clutches. Though registered as a pro-Israel lobby, but not as a foreign agent, these APACers are not lobbyists, since lobbying is no longer necessary, but are acting as the agents of an alternative foreign government, one that controls quite openly the U.S. Congress, two-thirds of which came to the Washington Convention Center to pay their respects to the man they regard as their leader. That, as they clearly demonstrated last year, and again this year, is not President Obama, but Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, to whom last year they gave 29 standing ovations when he appeared before a joint session of Congress 3 days after he had publicly dressed down President Obama as if he were an errant schoolboy. APAC's job is to look after Congress, Israel's most important occupied territory, and in keeping pace with Israel's expansion of settlements in Jerusalem and the West Bank, its degree of control over both the House and the Senate has also grown over the years to the point that there's not a single member of the U.S. Senate today that dares says a word of criticism regarding Israel or vote against a piece of APAC-authored legislation, nor is there a member of the House that can utter a word of concern for the Palestinians without also genuflecting to Israel. And now the overwhelming majorities of both houses are pushing the U.S. to fight another war on Israel's behalf, while the whole array of Republican presidential candidates, the notable exception of Ron Paul, are acting as cheerleaders for Tel Aviv, hoping to attract the votes of the millions of politically and socially dysfunctional Christian evangelicals who've been convinced to put Israel's interests before those of their country. At some point, I expect a majority of Americans will say they have had enough of this, and I, and many of you, already have. My guest for today's program, former Senator James Aberesk, had more than enough of APAC and its ways when he represented South Dakota from 1973 to 1979 in the U.S. Senate, and at about 20 minutes past the hour, we'll be speaking to him of his experiences in getting his opinion about the role and power of APAC today. Before I get Senator Aberesk on the phone, let's get the views of a couple of other longtime observers whose views on this issue are close to mine. The first is that of Gideon Levy, a columnist for Israel's Haaretz, a newspaper, and a former guest on Takes on the World. On the eve of Netanyahu's arrival in Washington and his meeting with Obama, Levy wrote, quote, "An elephant and an ant will meet in Washington on Monday for a critical summit. But wait, who here is the elephant and who is the ant? Who is the superpower and who is the patronage state? A new chapter is being written in the history of nations," wrote Levy. "Never before has a small country dictated to a superpower. Never before has the chirp of the cricket sounded like a roar. Never has the elephant resembled the ant, and vice versa. No Roman province dared tell Julius Caesar what to do. No tribe ever dreamed of forcing Genghis Khan to act in accordance with its own tribal interests. Only Israel does this. On Monday, when Barack Obama and Benjamin Netanyahu meet at the White House," noted Levy, "it'll be hard to tell which one is the real leader of the world. For the past few years, the Israeli cricket has been chirping Iran, and the world responds with a muffled echo," Levy continued. "It isn't that Iran is only an Israeli problem, but North Korea could endanger Japan just as much as Iran endangers Israel, and the world has not come running to Japan's side. Netanyahu's Israel has dictated the global agenda as no small state has ever done before, just as its international standing is at its nadir and its dependence on the United States at its zenith. That was, end quote. That was Gideon Levy in Israel's Haaretz newspaper writing an opinion piece that no U.S. newspaper would dare publish. Then we have, on this side of the water, M.J. Rosenberg, a senior policy fellow at Media Matters Action Network, who worked 18 years on Capitol Hill for several members of Congress, and from 1982 to 1986 edited the AIPAC newsletter, Nearest Report. Let's agree that he knows Washington. Here's what he says. By the way, he's also a supporter of Israel, but not its government or policies, nor its pushing for war in Iraq. Watching the AIPAC conference, he wrote, I was horrified to see an ostensibly pro-Israel organization promoting a war that presents an existential threat to Israel's survival. I vehemently oppose the very idea of war with Iran, and am appalled by the right-wing Israeli government, but even more by its supporters here at home, who are trying to push the president to either bomb or support the bombing of Iran. Not surprisingly, I have been under assault by various people on the right for my vigorous criticism of AIPAC and its role in promoting confrontation with Iran. My critics, continues Rosenberg, are particularly irked that I use the term Israel firster to describe people who, in my opinion, put the interest of the Israeli right above everything else. This includes politicians such as Newt Gingrich, who, as far as I know, is not Jewish. Watching the AIPAC conference convinced me that I must recommit myself to fighting those who are working to lead this country and or Israel to war in Iran, end quote. While having decided to no longer use the term Israel firsters, Levy writes, Rosenberg writes, many of the same people who pushed us into Iraq are doing the same thing with Iran. They are pressuring Congress to prevent the President of the United States from negotiating with the Iranian government. They are banning diplomatic contacts. They are, as they have for decades, hyping the Iranian threat, in part because they want a war and in part because they want to use President Obama's reluctance to jeopardize lives as a tool to defeat him in November. And they are demanding that should Iran develop a nuclear bomb, we must not contain the threat as we did with the Soviet Union, China, North Korea, Pakistan, etc., but should immediately go to war, unquote. Now, I've read you these comments from Gideon Levy and M.J. Rosenberg because with the possibility of an attack of Iran being discussed openly in Washington and Israel, I think they are important, and search as you will on your radio dial or your television dial, you are not likely to hear them anywhere else. You'll also not read them in the New York Times, whose opinion pages are readily available to Israeli warmongers, and the Washington Post ditto or the Wall Street Journal ditto. You will not hear them on the network and cable news programs because, like the half dozen foundations and think tanks that dominate Washington, they too have taken the Netanyahu government's side against that of U.S. president, declaring that it is Obama's job to get Israel to trust him, and they continue to write this despite Obama having virtually presented his sword of surrender to Israel, to AIPAC, and to Netanyahu when he spoke at last weekend's conference. And here's what he said. This isn't just about numbers on a balance sheet. As a senator, I spoke to Israeli troops on the Lebanese border. I visited with families who have known the terror of rocket fire in Sderot. And that's why, as president, I have provided critical funding to deploy the Iron Dome system that has intercepted rockets that might have hit homes and hospitals and schools in that town and in others. The president goes on. Now our assistance in expanding Israel's defensive capabilities so that more Israelis can live free from the fear of rockets and ballistic missiles, because no family, no citizen should live in fear. I say that's okay, I guess, for Palestinians whose suffering Obama never mentions and who's in far more danger from rockets and missiles than our Israelis, as we have seen again these recent days. Back to the president. And just as we have been there with our security assistance, we've been there through our diplomacy. When the Goldstone Report unfairly singled out Israel for criticism, we challenged it. When Israel was isolated in the aftermath of the flotilla incident, we supported them. The president failing to mention that among the nine killed by the Israelis was one American citizen. When they go back to Obama, when the Durban conference was commemorated, we boycotted it, and we will always reject the notion that Zionism is racism. When one-sided resolutions are brought up at the Human Rights Council, we oppose them. When Israeli diplomats fear for their lives in Cairo, we intervene to save them. When their efforts to boycott or divest from Israel, we will stand against them. and whenever an effort is made to delegitimize the state of Israel, my administration has opposed them. So there should be not a shred of doubt by now. When the chips are down, I have Israel's back, end quote. Well, that was not good enough for 86 House Republicans, which 3 days later sent him a letter with all their signatures attached, which critically noted that, quote, our relationship with Israel has taken a particularly discouraging turn with respect to the starkly different views of Iran held by Israel and your administration. Although your administration has stated that, quote, all options are on the table, end quote, you have offered little evidence to back up this statement. We have already waited too long, Mr. President. Now is not the time for platitudes regarding one of the greatest threats Israel has ever faced. We cannot stress strongly enough of the need to repair broken relations with Israeli leaders, end quote. But short of signing letters, the view expressed by these 86 Republicans differ only in tone, not content, from those expressed by the majority of Democrats. And speaking of the Democrats, and changing the subject, it should be noted that not a single one voted against H.R. 347 last month, a piece of legislation that was deceptively entitled, quote, the Federal Restricted Buildings and Grounds Improvement Act of 2011, which President Obama signed into law on March 8th, making it Public Law 112-98. Plain and simple, it may represent the most draconian violation of our civil liberties since the days of the Joe McCarthy and the Cold War. It is described in its summary as amending the federal criminal code to revise the prohibition against entering restricted federal buildings or grounds to impose criminal penalties on anyone who knowingly enters any restricted building or grounds without lawful authority. Now, it defines restricted buildings or grounds as a posted, cordoned off, or otherwise restricted area of, one, the White House or its grounds, or the president's official residence or its grounds, two, a building or grounds where the president or other person protected by the Secret Service is or will be temporarily visiting, or three, a building or ground so restricted due to a special event of national significance, end quote. In other words, this law now makes it unlawful to carry the protest against a president or candidate protected by the Secret Service inside any building where that president or candidate may happen to be, whether it's a hotel or the nominating conventions of both the Democratic and Republican parties. That also would include foreign heads of state who receive Secret Service protection, such as Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu or any other high-ranking Israeli official. As the law reads, quote, whoever, one, knowingly enters or remains in any restricted buildings or grounds without lawful authority to do so, two, knowingly and with intent to impede or disrupt the orderly conduct of government business or official functions, engages in disorderly or disruptive conduct in or within such proximity to any restricted building or grounds when or so that such conduct in fact impedes or disrupts the orderly conduct of government business or official functions, three, knowingly and with the intent to impede or disrupt the orderly conduct of government, business, or official functions, cocktail parties, etc., obstructs or impedes ingress or egress to or from any restricted building or grounds, or four, knowingly engages in any act of physical violence against any person or property in any restricted building or grounds, can be fined or sentenced up to 10 years or both if the person arrested uses or carries a deadly weapon, or fined if the offense results in significant bodily injury, and fined or imprisoned for not more than 1 year or both in any other case. That's civil disobedience. In other words, someone arrested for nonviolent civil disobedience for sitting in at a site determined to be of, quote, national significance, unquote, can anticipate spending a year in prison. An earlier version of the bill would have made it a felony just to conspire to engage in any of the conduct I described. So the humanists got rid of that part. What has passed and is now law has been described by those critics who know about it, and they're not many, as the anti-Occupy law, and it was rushed through Congress under a suspension of the rules designed to cut debate short and pass the bill. This requires a two-thirds majority for passage and is a process usually reserved for non-controversial legislation. Whereas the Senate passed the bill with unanimous consent, where are you, Bernie? The House took a roll call vote with 399 A's, three nays, and 30 declaring themselves present or not voting. The three opposing votes were all by Republicans: presidential candidate Ron Paul, Palestinian American Justin Amash from Michigan, and Paul Bruin from Georgia. This bill was an obvious must-pass piece of legislation from both parties. What it says about the Democratic Party and Dennis Kucinich, who was forced to run a Democratic primary in a gerrymandered district and who lost Marcy Kaptur, I'll leave to you, because he voted for it. Rather, this would be voting present, as did Lynn Woolsey. Well, finally, we have Walmart back on the agenda, and tonight's meeting of the Ukiah Planning Commission may represent a moment of truth in the lives of each and every commissioner, as well as the city of Ukiah. The commissioners will be deciding whether Walmart's desire to expand into a 24/7 full-service supermarket is more important to the people of Ukiah than the lives of those who may be endangered by the traffic snafus that are certain to occur at the 101 Talmadge Airport Boulevard interchange, should the project be allowed to go ahead. To approve the project, the commission is required by the California Environmental Quality Act. We'll ask the planning department to produce a statement of overriding considerations for a subsequent meeting, which will describe how the benefits of adding a Walmart supermarket to Ukiah is worth risking the lives of the people of Ukiah and those who may be passing through on Highway 101. Public comment on the issue is closed, but a strong showing by opponents of the project might send a equally strong signal to the Planning Commission as to where the people of Ukiah, who the Planning Commission is supposed to represent, stand on this issue. That's at 300 Seminary Avenue in Ukiah at 6 p.m. tonight.